It's toast. And you're listening to Perpetual Notion Machine. I'm your host, Serena Zhao. So I've got a couple of loaves of bread right here with us. I don't know if you can hear this, but I've got a beautiful crusty loaf of bread. Oh, there we go. I'm gonna tear it open, take a look at what's inside. Oh, there. Got a nice, beautiful open crumb. And if you've ever thought about why, what makes it possible for bread to have that wonderful texture inside, it's thanks to the gluten protein that makes the dough elastic enough to expand and hold the bubbles of air produced by the yeast. Over the years, bakers have developed a wide knowledge base of how gluten proteins operate and how to manipulate their properties to create a wide range of breads and cakes and pastries and all these things that we love. And building on that, modern food science research has really honed our understanding of not just gluten, but many of the physical and chemical properties that make the foods that are familiar to us what they are. So tonight on PNM, we are joined by Dr. Audrey Gerard, Assistant Professor of Food Science at UW-Madison. Dr. Gerard has extensive experience in grain science and notably gluten functionality. And so thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Gerard.
Thank you, Serena. I'm glad to be here.
Great. So let's start with some background, because food science is a pretty wide field, I imagine. What does a food scientist do, and how do you do it?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we can do a whole lot of different things. So it can be anywhere from making sure the food is safe, so working on like the microbiology of the food, to looking at how the food is processed, so more of an engineering bent to that. Or like me, I work on the food chemistry side of it. So I look at how the food actually functions, whether it's how it, the quality changes over time. So over its storage life, or how processing affects the quality, like that loaf of bread you just shared. Wish I was in the studio with you and we could share a slice, right?
Yeah, it that smells real good.
But yeah, so we work on just a range of different aspects of food. So everything from taking it from the harvest to the producer, or excuse me, to the consumer, whatever that may be.
Yeah. So what are some of the chemical properties that that you have to pay attention to as a grower or a producer that maybe as consumers we don't always notice?
So some of the things I'm really concerned with: protein quality and protein chemistry. So that can be changed by the genetics and the environment, basically. So if we're thinking about wheat, right? If we have a year where it's really wet or a lot cooler than normal, then the wheat proteins won't be developed as well. So we'll have a lower protein content, and it may not make as good of a loaf of bread. So in that case, you're sourcing different wheats from different areas to get the right qualities that you want in your wheat, in your flour.
Wow. So how do you measure or come to know what is the outcome after, a weather that might not be what you might expect for that year at the end of the growing season?
There's usually a lot of testing that's going on of different wheat qualities. So that can happen at the elevator where they're just looking at protein content. And moisture and things like that, all the way to, after they've harvested it and the farmer's taken it to the elevator, they test that kind of thing. But then also when you send it to millers, so they're going to turn it into flour, they're going to look at if it has any enzyme damage. So if the starches have been damaged and the viscosity of the batter would be too low, they're going to look at the protein quality. So that could be some type of a quick mixing test, because that correlates really well with bread quality, which a lot of the hard winter wheats or the hard wheats are made into breads. And so those are the main characteristics they're looking for.
Wow. So other than bread, what are some other uses that you might have to try to funnel your different flour outcomes into?
Yeah, so that's a good point. So first, let me back up and start with the fact that we have six different classes of wheat in the U.S.
Okay, so it's not just white and hole.
Yeah, no, it's not just, you know, all purpose flour, bread flour, and whole flour, whole wheat flour that you can find on the supermarket shelf. So there's again, the six different main classes. The first one is durum. So that's what's used to make pasta. It has a really high protein content. And then we have hard red winter and hard red spring. Those are both bread type wheats. Typically, spring usually has a little bit higher protein content, so it's good for some of those more hearth-like breads. So that bread I think you just broke open, that's probably something like a hard red spring. Whereas hard red winter has a little bit lower protein content, but is great for things like sandwich bread. And then we have hard white. So this is great for any time you don't want the color that comes from the red endosperm. So if you want a whole wheat product, but you want it to have that little bit of a purer look, a hard white is a good option there. And then there's two soft varieties. So soft white is used for things like wedding cakes, where you want that bright white color, but you also don't need so much of the gluten strength. So both of the softer wheats have a lower gluten content and gluten strength. And then soft red is used for different pastry applications, but things like cookies would be a good example.
So if we, for a typical consumer at a grocery store, the bag of flour that you might get, would that be a mix of some of these varieties, or is it like one or the other?
Yeah, exactly. It's probably a mix. So they've blended it to get the functionality that they're looking for. So the type of glutens that they're looking for are the qualities of the gluten. They've blended it to get, you know, the right protein content as well as the right mixing properties.
Gotcha.
So it's probably a mix of something like hard red winter and maybe some hard red spring.
So you mentioned gluten a few times, and you also mentioned starch damage. Could you explain a little bit, what are the components of flour, and what are the parts of the seed, and what ends up being important as we use it for baking?
Yeah, thanks for that question. So if we think of a seed, of a wheat seed, right? We have the bran, the outer part, that protects the embryo, the germ, and then we have the endosperm, and that's the part where we really get the flour. So the germ is what grows into the stalk of wheat. But if we're just milling it, we're separating out usually the germ and the bran and leaving just the endosperm, so that nice white fluffy part that we're going to get out. In the bran, that's mostly hemicelluloses, really complex starches that we're not going to digest, fibers and things. And a little bit of protein. The germ is where most of the fats are. But again, a seed of wheat has really low fat content, but that's just for the reproduction purposes. And then the endosperm is where we have mostly starch and protein.
So what do the starches and the proteins do for the wheat plant? And then what do they do for us?
Yeah, so for the wheat plant, I always think of it like the germ has a backpack. So it has that endosperm backpack that's its food. So as it's growing, it has the energy it needs. So that's what the starch and the protein do for the seed wheat. For us, they make tasty, tasty foods, right? So we get that flour and then we hydrate it into some type of a batter for a cake or a dough for a bread. And the glutens are really important in dough type applications. So thinking about the bread, right? Because they form a matrix. So if we think of it like just a netting of all these proteins, and then the starches are and the other ingredients that we have in our matrix are stuck in this gluten matrix. So as the dough rises, if we're fermenting it, it's expanding, but all these starch granules and everything are kept in this matrix, but it holds the air in. And then as we bake it, the starch starts to gelatinize, so it kind of cooks and softens, right? But then the gluten structure also sets, so it holds up that matrix, and it really provides the nice structural elements for our loaf of bread.
So you mentioned that different varieties would have different amounts of gluten. What's the outcome of if you have more gluten or less gluten in a flour?
Yeah, so if we're talking about, so from the different types, right? So if you're talking about soft, that's not gonna form, or soft wheat is not gonna form a great matrix, a protein matrix. So it wouldn't make a great loaf of bread, but it is good in a product where you don't want to form that gluten matrix as much, like in a cake, where you want more of the starches to have time to gelatinize and form the structure, and get that nice soft texture.
Okay, so less gluten, fluffy and soft.
Yeah, that's a pretty good way to put it.
Let's see. Yeah, so you mentioned these different cultivars of wheat. Where were they developed? Is this something like, are all these varieties grown in North America, for example? And like, did they evolve here or where do they come from?
Yes, so that's a little bit more into history than I can get. But I mean, I can tell you that the present day development is happening at universities, as well as at private industry. So for instance, on campus here, Julie Dawson works with wheat breeding and works with local bakers to try to develop wheat varieties that have the traits that they're really looking for to make that next great loaf of bread. Previously, before being here at UW-Madison, I was at Texas A&M and I was part of the wheat improvement program where I worked with breeders and agronomists to try to develop wheat varieties that had these properties that were good for different applications. And one of those applications was tortillas. So we were actually looking, you mentioned when you were talking about gluten in the opening that you want it to be elastic, which is true, but you also want it to be viscous. So you want it to have viscoelasticity. So the elasticity is brought in by the glutenin protein. So there's two fractions of gluten proteins, right? We have the glutenin proteins that are a little bit larger and they act more elastic. So if we think of like a rubber band, when it snaps back together, that's that elasticity that we're looking for. But conversely, we also want some viscousness. So we want to be able to stretch. That's brought in by the gliadin proteins, the other fraction of the gluten proteins. And it allows for extensibility. And so together, these two components, the glutenins and the gliadins, make up the gluten. And we can change through genetics, we can change the composition, so the relative amount of either one of those fractions. And then there's subfractions within those, but that gets really into the weeds. But as part of this wheat improvement program, we were looking at different varieties that had, say, a high protein content but really high gliadin. So they were really extensible but not as elastic. So they didn't make a great loaf of bread, which is, again, typically the qualities that you're looking for in a hard wheat. But they made great tortillas. So when you make a tortilla, typically the processing is you make a dough ball and then you send it through a hot press. And that presses it down out into the tortilla shape, right? And when you press it, you want it to stay in a nice diameter. You don't want it to shrink back. If it has too much elasticity, it shrinks back, right? But since it has a lot of gliadins, it's more extensible. So it stays extended. Then it's baked. And then we need a high protein content to have it be pretty shelf stable so that it doesn't lose the texture properties we're looking for over time. So if it's a low protein content, it's going to become really crumbly as it sits on the shelf, whereas a higher protein content is going to have that nice rollability that we're looking for in a tortilla shell.
Wow. So even something like shelf life, where I would normally think of it as, you know, processing afterwards or additives or something, the genetic components of the actual crop are a major part of that. That's really interesting.
Yeah, they can be. So, of course, we have tools that we can use to extend the shelf life further. But as consumers are looking more and more for simple ingredient statements, breeders and geneticists are really looking at these plants and saying, well, how can we make a cleaner ingredient statement? How can we improve the plant, whatever it is, so that we don't have to add these additives later down the line?
Wow. So I didn't realize that there were new varieties being developed right now continuously. Does it, as something is, let's say, being bred in a university lab and then eventually it'll make it out into the field, what's kind of the timescale of something like that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it's not quick. It takes 13 to 15 years from the time they develop the original, they cross whatever progeny, you know, they're going to cross. And then you start with one seed and you increase and increase and select for the traits that you're looking for and throw out the ones that didn't cross correctly. And yeah, it takes a long time. And so quality doesn't come in. So say the first 5 years, that's really just happening in a greenhouse. That's just the breeders looking at the products, the wheat that's growing. And then at about the 5 year mark, you can start running some type of food quality analyses. You still don't have a ton of sample to work with, but you can start looking at some of those properties. Yeah, so it's a pretty involved process. So getting it out the door is a really exciting feat.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a lot of people involved in this really long pipeline.
Yes, there are.
So I guess when you have the major building blocks in the endosperm of the starch and the proteins, but the plant has a lot of other stuff going on, right? Or you might add ingredients as you're in the cooking process. What are some other factors that end up affecting the outcome of any sort of, I don't know, protein structure or other properties of the food? Sorry, that's really general.
Yeah, no, that's
what can affect your food?
When we're thinking, bread is just an easy example. I have lots of examples of that. So when we're thinking about bread quality, we can add either reagents, reducing or oxidizing agents to either make the gluten weaker or stronger, depending on what we need. So we can add something like a polyphenol is typically a reducing agent. So polyphenols come in all kinds of plants. They are the secondary metabolites in plants. They're pretty ubiquitous and they can produce different colors. But they also serve in the plant typically to protect it from predation from birds. However, as a reducing agent for the glutens, it breaks apart those disulfide bonds. So the bonds that are between the individual gluten units that really give us that nice gluten matrix, it breaks those apart. So it can make for a weaker matrix. So if we're looking for something, for example, in the tortillas where we don't want that elasticity, we might use a reducing agent to increase the extensibility a little bit.
So is that something... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
That was just going to say, that's somewhere where we'd use something like a polyphenol, some type of reducing agent.
Gotcha. So is the polyphenol something that would already be in, you know, different amounts in different cultivars, or is that something more down the line in the cooking process?
Yes. Yeah, so wheat does have polyphenols in it already, but that's in the bran typically. That's actually one of the confounding factors if you're trying to make a loaf of whole wheat bread that affects the quality. But typically we would use a polyphenol from somewhere else. So you would extract it from something like green tea, for example.
Wow. Okay. What about, so when you talk about things that might interrupt the gluten matrix, kind of first thing that pops into my head is fat. So can you talk a little bit about the role of fat in the gluten matrix and, you know, fat that might come from the wheat or fat that we might add as we're, you know, putting together a recipe?
Yeah, so the fat that comes from the wheat is pretty it's very low amount, right? So more we're thinking about how much fat we're going to add. So let's go back to the bread examples. If we think of a hearth bread, so something like a true French baguette or a really crusty loaf of sourdough bread, right? That has a pretty low amount of fat in the process in the formulation. But if you think of something like a sandwich bread, so think of like Wonder Bread, they have a higher amount of fat in there. So you get that softer texture. So if you're just thinking about biting into either one of those, you can think about how the one with fat has a much softer bite, a softer texture, mouthfeel. It also has much smaller air cells, right? The air cells are more closely packed together and it has a more regular structure. So that's what adding the fat can help do. Whereas in those more artisan type breads, the hearth breads, you get a more open air cell structure. And it usually has more of a kind of off-white color. not because of the fat itself, but because of the size of those air cells, right? So they're more irregular and they don't catch the same light the same way.
Oh, so the color of bread in this way is like a butterfly wing, and that it's something, sometimes some of it is due to the way the light is being manipulated, not necessarily like the pigments itself.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
So, I mean, of course, if you're thinking of something like a whole wheat loaf of bread, there's going to be color from that. But if we're just thinking about flour, I could use the same flour in two loaves of bread, and depending on how much fat I put in it, could end up with totally different color in the crumb, not even just the crust.
Interesting. So if we have some time, I wonder if there's any sort of current research projects that you've got going on, or some recent findings that you might be able to share.
Yeah, I'd love to. So I mentioned polyphenols earlier, and this is actually where a lot of my work is. So polyphenols can modify protein structure. I mentioned through reducing the protein crosslinks, but they can also build other crosslinks and proteins. So tannins are the specific polyphenols I'm looking at and I'm working with. So tannins, you might have heard of them in things like red wine. They're those components that make your mouth really dry and kind of pucker. But they can also, again, kind of cross-link these proteins, mostly through non-covalent interactions. So it's a different type of interaction than usually what's happening between the proteins. But I'm looking at how we can use these to improve protein structure and function as a natural additive. Because again, they can come from things like grapes, they can come from cranberries, which is a big product up here in Wisconsin. They can come from cocoa, a lot of different products. So we're looking at adding them to different protein matrices to restructure them. So one thing I found in my PhD research was as we heated these gluten proteins, they start to unravel, which this is well known that when you denature proteins, right, they're going to unravel. But interestingly, we found that as they're unraveling, they interact with these polyphenols, these tannins, a little bit better and make a little bit stronger of a matrix. So we're seeing if we can use that effect in other ways. One example is we're looking at pulse proteins. So things like pea and fava bean and lentils. We're looking at if we can restructure those and make a stronger matrix to give things like plant-based meats a better bite. So it'd have a more meat-like feel or texture. So that's one example of where we're using them.
Wow. So something like tannins, what are the tannins interacting with in the pulse proteins?
Yeah.
Or, so yeah, what are the pulse proteins, I guess?
Yeah. So the pulse proteins are just the different fractions. So take a pea, right? It's about 20% protein content. And we can manipulate those through processing. So we can do a process called extrusion, where you heat them and shear them and force them through a die. And this will restructure the proteins as they cool down. And that's already used in texturized proteins, right, to make these plant-based meats. But a lot of people find that they don't have enough texture, that they don't have enough bite. And so these polyphenols can help to make, again, as we're restructuring, as we're extruding, we're hoping that they're going to make a little bit tighter of a matrix. So kind of interact the proteins a little bit more and give us a better texture.
So to give us a sense of what this research might look like, what would you do to study this? Is this like you were extruding pea proteins in the lab, or how does this work?
Yes, that's a great question. So we study the pea protein and polyphenol interactions on their own, so just mixing on a benchtop. But then we're also going to move up to extrusion. So at first, we're just looking at how are these proteins and polyphenols interacting? What levers can we use to adjust the interaction? So is that temperature? Is that pH? Mixing method? What can we do there? And then we'll move on to using an extruder and making a example texturized protein.
Wow. So moving from the lab benchtop to a kitchen benchtop, based on the research that you've done or that you've seen in the field, do you have any lessons that home cooks and bakers might be able to take from kind of the cutting edge of food science research?
That's a great question. So it's not specifically tied to my research. I don't have findings that are ready to deploy yet. But I'm going to turn it back and ask you a question. Do you know the difference between baking soda and baking powder?
The acid, right?
Yes. Yeah. So baking powder is baking soda, sodium bicarbonate, with a little bit of acid added to it. So if you're in a pinch at home and you need baking powder, but you don't have it, you can use baking soda and add buttermilk or lemon juice or some other acidulant to the recipe. And that can save you there.
Yeah, that's handy. You only really need one then.
Yeah.
Great. So I think we are just about wrapping up. So Andre, thank you so much for joining us. More information about Dr. Girard's research is available at foodsci.wisc.edu or her lab specifically at girard.foodsci.wisc.edu. My name is Serena Zhao. Thank you for listening.